Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey.
Welcome to this episode of The Movie Log. Today, we're traveling back to 1950 to discuss the American drama All About Eve. Written and directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. Produced by Daryl F. Zanuck, who had one of the longest careers in Hollywood. And starring Betty Davis, Ann Baxter, George Sanders, Gary Merrill, and Hugh Marlowe. For those of you that are not familiar with the story, it is basically a story of a young woman named Eve, who uses her connections and guile to get ahead in the theater world.
So, Dad, how are you doing today? How's life? How's it going?
Doing good. Doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
So, why did you pick this film?
Well, partly, disclaimer. Before we had watched this movie, I had never seen this movie before, which kind of breaks our rules that we've set up for ourselves. But one of the reasons why I chose this movie is that a couple of months ago, NPR has these reading hours on Saturdays or Sundays. And one of the reading hours that they were doing is some really cool woman who I don't remember her name was reading the short story, The Wisdom of Eve, which is what this movie is based off of. And I was really interested in the short story that she was reading. And my mom, who was like, oh, this is all about Eve. It's a really good movie. It's so cool. And I went, oh, that's so cool. And then somebody suggested it for our season two on Instagram. And I was like, oh, someone suggested it and all this stuff. And you know, my mom was saying it was a good movie, and I was really interested in the short story, and so I was like, you know what, let's do this for our podcast. So technically, this is our first, actually not technically, it is our first suggestion box episode.
All right. Betty Davis is known for this film. This is one of the roles that when Betty Davis, you go back in her career, you look at it, it's considered one of her great performances, if not just flat out a great performance in film. So do you think her performance as Margot Channing deserves a lot of the praise that it's been getting over the years?
I think she's a wonderful actress just by her own right. So it's really hard to separate the performance from the actor or actress. But I definitely do think this one is definitely a highlight in her career. I've seen couple of the things that she has made, and most of them have been highlights because she has over 100 credits to her name, and so you can't watch all of them unless you're super dedicated. So I bet you there is somebody who's seen all of them, but I've seen most of the highlights, and I think this one is a highlight of a highlight. You could technically go by the facts as well. You know, she was nominated for an Oscar, and a lot of people base performances on awards. She was nominated, but she didn't win. This movie continues to be reviewed, and people write articles about it all the time, even up to this day. And most of the articles are about how amazing she is in this movie. So you could also base that on that, and also for the fact that when in 2008, when they had in America, they had postage stamps for her anniversary of her 100th birthday, and the stamps were her as Margot Channing. So it's kind of seen as this iconic role in her filmography.
So how do you feel about it when you watched it? Did you think it held up to that much praise and being held up, or were you like expecting more out of the movie because you've heard so much about it over the years?
I honestly think it's a really good performance. There's definitely that scene in the during the audition, or not during the audition, which is one of the reasons why the scene is so memorable, where it could have been melodramatic, but because she is that Bette Davis is such a wonderful actress, it doesn't lean into the overdramatic soap opera. It's too much emotion that it pulls you out of the movie. This movie's very grounded in reality, and so I think her performance in this movie has definitely brought the All About Eve cast one step closer to amazingness.
What did you think was the biggest surprise for you when you watched it?
It's a tough question. I think part of the reason, you know what? One of the biggest surprises for me is that what they decided to change and to help with the story more, because she has a husband in the short story, Margot Channing does, but instead of giving her a husband, they give her a boyfriend that turns into her husband. And that was kind of like, as a person who loves storytelling, what they decided to change to help the audience and help the story being told, just kind of, it doesn't shock me. What's the word I'm looking for? It's curious to me what they decide to change. And what they decide to keep the same, especially when it is it's faithful to the short story.
Fairly much.
Fairly. You know, every story to every book to a movie has some differences, but.
What did you think about seeing a young Marilyn Monroe in the film and the cast?
I thought it was so funny because at first when she walked in, I was like, that looks like Marilyn Monroe. And I was like, wait, that can't be Marilyn Monroe. And then I was like, wait, that's Marilyn Monroe. And then you pointed, and then you go, hey, do you know who that is? And I went, that's Marilyn Monroe, right? And you're like, yes. I was like, oh my God, it is Marilyn Monroe.
It's funny because this movie, it comes from a different perspective for me. I mean, Marilyn Monroe, of course, when I first saw this movie years ago, I thought of, oh, it's Marilyn Monroe. Both Hugh Marlowe and Gary Merrill were in a movie that I grew up watching called 12 O'Clock High, which was made only 2-3 years before this. And they were the male leads along with Gregory Peck about this bomber command in England during World War II. And so whenever I watched the movie, it's like, oh, I know who those guys are. And, you know, I was like, and so I came at it from a different perspective. Like, I knew these actors from other movies, and so it was very interesting. And then to find out that they both kind of got the parts because of that movie, so.
It's kind of like when you're watching Law and Order, because Law and Order has been going on for, especially with all of its spinoffs and stuff, has been going on for 20-plus years, right? And so to me, seeing the Marilyn Monroe and All About Eve is exactly like when I go and watch like Law and Order, Criminal Intent, and there's like the episode with John Krasinski.
Maybe you should pick somebody else.
Now you've messed me up. I said it right imperfectly the first time.
No, you didn't. Do you want to hear it?
No. But when you see him as a drug dealer, you're kind of like, wait, isn't that Jim from The Office? So it's kind of like that. Or like when you see like Claire Danes as a victim and you're like, wait, isn't that Claire Danes? And so it totally felt like that, where I was like, wait, that's Marilyn Monroe, right? You know, apparently she got the role because she, her agent put out a campaign to get her into this movie. And with, you know, this was kind of like a stepping stone to all her big break.
And then you also found out that she was going up against Angela Lansbury for the part.
Which blows my mind because you know, Marilyn Monroe lives in a different part of your head than Angela Lansbury. Angela Lansbury is only 1 year older than Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And so you're just kind of like, you're like, Miss Potts and Marilyn Monroe don't mix, you know. But
yep, that makes sense.
It totally makes sense. It's one of those things too, when somebody dies young, they're young in your head forever.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the Bette Davis thing, because you did ask me if I thought this was a, you know, many top 100 lists always put her in like the 1 to 5, you know, spots and things like that for best performances. But you studied film when you were younger, so I as an audience member could be like, oh my god, it's amazing, woo. But you studied the composition of film. Do you think that this performance holds up over time?
Yeah. Well, it's also, it's a performance you can tell that was worked with the director. The way that he would stage and shoot and set the camera up, edit going in and out of scenes, you could totally tell that she worked with him. Now, I don't know how the working relationship was and if it was very smooth, but at least...
Actually, it was really smooth. A lot of people said, she's hard to work with. She'll rewrite the script, blah, 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 blah. She actually, when I was doing research, there's a lot of quotes of him saying that she was the most professional, his favorite actress to ever work with, things like that, because she's had so much respect for his script that she did exactly what he wanted her to do.
Okay, cool. I didn't know that. You can see that they worked together in tandem to make sure that when she says certain lines, they're delivered not only acting-wise in a certain way to evoke and support the script, but the camera work supported the delivery so that when she was saying it, it made sense. Like, back to that audition scene, there were times where the camera moved below her and above her to show you that when she had power in the situation, when she was losing power in the situation, the way that certain people were shot farther away, sinking in the seat so that they didn't want, you know, things like that, that it was shot in such a way that you could turn down the sound and you could still get a gist of what was going on, which is a sign of a really well-crafted film. And I really liked her performance. Like you said, it verged sometimes on being melodramatic, but she was also playing an actress, and sometimes she was using that as a tool to get what she wanted.
Like a character choice.
Yeah, like a character choice. Like she's like saying, okay, if I overplay this, if I do this a little too heavy, I'm gonna get what I want. So I really enjoyed the film back when I saw it years ago. And then watching it again, I was able to, since I kind of knew where the story was going, I was able just to watch the choices that were made in the filmmaking process. And I thought it really was, there were some of these actors, this was like some of their best work ever, you know, like Hugh Marlowe and Gary Merrill. They would go do a couple more films, but essentially go back to doing television for the rest of their career. And these guys gave great performances through this entire film. So it's also it's a really good indicator that how good of a director Joseph L. Mankiewicz was, and how much a good writer he was. This is the second to last film I think he wrote, or no, he wrote more than that.
He wrote more.
So
this is kind of like in the middle of his career. This is when he was working with 20th Century Fox.
Okay.
And yeah. we did talk about Cleopatra in our season one, and that's the end of his career, kind of blew up in his face. But this is like when he's known for being on top of his game.
Well, I also think that, well, that movie was also taken away from him and then was blamed. He was blamed for not doing well. So that's also one of those. He went on to direct. I think after Cleopatra, he directed films, but he never wrote films.
Yeah, The Honey Pot is the last movie, I think, that he wrote and directed.
Yeah.
But we talked about this a lot more in our Cleopatra episode. So if you wanna go back, shameless plugging.
But I think the thing, too, with his writing style, he's very classically trained as a writer, so his stuff is very solid, has a good foundation. And even when you're watching Cleopatra, you can see that there's the beginnings of scenes, and there's a movie in there that they didn't end up making because of studio control, or they didn't end up editing because of studio control. And I also feel like when he went off and directed, I would not be, and didn't write, get credit for writing, I would not be surprised if he did script doctoring on the movies that he directed to make sure that they were solid movies. So, but yeah, I think it was really kind of cool to see the tandem of Bette Davis and Joseph L. Mankiewicz working together, because you can see that they were working together to get the film the way it should be.
Yeah, especially since we hear a lot of stories about Bette Davis, about how she like rewrites her own parts. And
well, yeah, you hear that and you have to take that with a grain of salt.
Well,
because,
yes.
Because there's two things. One, Bette Davis was extremely talented and knew filmmaking and knew film acting. So she knew what would get the best out there. And so she fought from that angle. Directors who usually had a good relationship with her were strong directors, like Joseph L. Mankiewicz. And they would say nice things about her. Directors who were not strong directors were usually the ones that were saying the things that were negative, or were very strong-willed and also had negative things said about them too. So I take that Bette Davis stuff with a grain of salt. There's different women throughout history and film. So these rumors get started about actresses and actors and directors, and it's a way of the studio kind of keeping power leverage over them. So this film was also favorably compared to Sunset Boulevard, which was directed by Billy Wilder. Last season we did The Apartment, that was directed by Billy Wilder.
Another shameless plug.
Sunset Boulevard was another story dealing with an actress who was perceived to be past her prime and how she was handling it. They both went in two different directions, of course. But how do you feel about Bette Davis dealing with the fact that she was 40 in the movie and everybody saying she's at the end of her career and being washed up, which really hasn't changed that much in Hollywood?
There's a common joke about like Meryl Streep is the only woman over the age of 40 who has a viable career, you know, which is not true.
Not as much as it
used to be, but it's a heavy joke within Hollywood.
Sally Field famously said once, they said that they asked Meryl Streep why she only did one movie 1 year. This is like 10, 15 years ago. And Meryl Streep said, well, I was only offered one script. And Sally Field said, I wish I was offered one script a year. And that's Sally Field, who's, you know, hugely talented and has a great career and has been going, still been going on, and she has to fight for parts. So it's like, you know that, and then you look around, it's like Dustin Hoffman's still working, you know, all these older actors are still working, and some of them still leading. And so that's a very interesting thing. One of my favorite films is Charade, and it's one at the end of Cary Grant's career, and Cary Grant insisted, even though it was a romantic comedy between him and Audrey Hepburn, who was like, I think it was at that time, like 35 years his junior. She was really young compared to him. He insisted that they put jokes in the movie that he was too old for her, because he thought it was stupid that in his mid-60s, he's running around with this young woman as a romantic lead. And so and that's one of the reasons why I like that movie, because it points out how stupid that is.
Well, there's that whole thing, too, where it's like, so-and-so being a male actor is this like romantic lead or whatever. And a famous woman is his mom. They're always like 3 years apart.
Yeah. 3 or 4 years
apart. And it's like, after a while it gets really annoying, where it's like, last year that famous actress was the main lead in a romantic comedy. Now she's playing only mother parts.
Well, it's a famous thing again, Sally Field with Tom Hanks.
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
Yeah, because she played the romantic lead in Punchline with Tom Hanks, and I think it was like 2 years later she's playing his mom in Forrest Gump. And so it's like, come on, guys, we know that. So it's kind of tough. So in this movie, two interesting things were done, which I thought was very unique for the script. One, she was over 40, and that's part of the reason why she's having some difficulty dealing with certain people in the movie, because she's coming to terms that people are starting to write that she's too old to play some of these parts she's playing on stage, number one. And number two, the person who she's in love with, the man she's in love with, who is a director, is 35. And there's people making side comments about that, too.
About how he's too young.
And how can she keep him and all this other stuff. So for 1950, that's actually a very forward-thinking film. And it's dealing with a lot of things that still is being dealt with now, which I think is one of the reasons why people still watch that movie and find it interesting. There's these things in it that you go, we're still dealing with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. And that leads us right into one of the main themes of this movie or these movies, because there was a huge, definitely in the 1950s, because a lot of movies in the 1950s to the 1960s had this trope of like, a woman past her prime in Hollywood or in the theater,
yeah,
in her career, and one of the things that I was thinking about was, because when I was doing research, and I don't know if this is true or anything, but I thought maybe it's because a lot of the actors from the golden age of Hollywood were finally turning 40.
Yeah, there was that,
and they've been there since the beginning.
Yeah, you had that. You also had women who had gone into the workforce during World War II, and then when the war was over, were expected to go back to being homemakers. And that didn't happen the way that people just thought it was. People thought everything was just going to snap back, and it didn't. And then you also had filmmakers, like actual directors, who were getting older too. And so they started making films that dealt with aging. So you have to understand, at this time, the film industry was, you know, roughly 45 years old. And depending on which starting point you choose of when studios and everything like that were started. And so you literally could have an actress who was born and raised seeing movies and then being in the film industry by, you know, the mid-30s, early to mid-30s, and now is hitting her prime. And then people in our society saying, no, that's past your prime. And so you had these great actresses who were doing – so it was prime for that kind of type of films. One of my favorite was I'm going to get the title wrong. I know it. It was Rock Hudson. It's another story about an older woman who falls in love with a younger man, and her family doesn't think it's right. And at the end, to tell her they love her and think that she's made the right choice of giving up her young love, they bring in a color TV set. Like, basically, like, okay, you're going to sit down on the couch and go out to pasture now, because this is where we feel you should be. There's definitely these films, like you said, that are being made at this time by different directors. And I think because you had some amazing actresses that could really pull off these roles and really do it, that there's some of these films stand the test of time. All About Eve, Sunset Boulevard, they're all through there. So,
well, it's also not a thing about just Hollywood. So it's like that storyline that you were just talking about how the older woman finds independence by falling in love with a younger man, but then she has to go and return back to her what society seems deemable. And you see that with like The Awakening, which is a book, you know, it was a novella in the turn of the century, you know? So it's a common thread with women about how, you know, once they reach past their prime, perceived prime, they're not allowed to explore or find new ways to reinvent life like the men are. They are meant to stay home with the children.
Well, I think the thing, the difference for me is that when the men are past their prime and they go out for the one last adventure, that's the male version of this. They go out for one last adventure. They do the one last thing. And sometimes it's very dramatic and they don't make it. Sometimes it's comedy, you know, it's like, and so there's definitely, depending on how you tell the story, it could be a lot of fun any way they do it. But the male version is the man is trying to somehow recapture his youth and the woman is trying somehow to validate her existence. Those are the two different takes on it. And then, you know, society is pretty much telling both of them that there's no need for them because we've moved on. So that's why this leads into the ageism discussion about how women are perceived and how men are perceived when they're perceived to be too old or past their prime. I think the thing for me when I was watching Bette Davis is that how she just grabbed that idea.
You mentioned something when we were watching this movie about how there's only can be one woman on top.
Oh, yeah. This is definitely one of those films that uses that. Yeah. Which I'm really glad that it's starting to shift in movies now. But you can pretty much look at a lot of films from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. There's one dominant woman, and there's either a woman trying to become the dominant woman, or the dominant woman is then somehow knocked off that pedestal and a woman replaces her. And that's basically what happens. There's four women in this movie that are main characters or main supporting characters. And there's two women at the beginning who have given that up. One is Birdie, who used to be in vaudeville and at the top of her game because she mentions it a couple times, but has since moved on and now is Margot's dresser. And then there's Margot's best friend, Karen, who is married to the playwright played by Hugh Marlowe. And so she, even though she went to Radcliffe and she has the money and the education and the family, she has decided to take herself out of the running and become a housewife, which in 1950s society means you've pulled yourself out. I know that she did a lot of work as a housewife, but that's not the point of the movie. And then there is Eve, and then there is...
Does not pull herself out.
Nope. And then there is Margot, and Eve is trying to get to the top, and Margot's at the top. Just by that description, you know where the main conflict is in this film. And that's used in screenwriting and story structure a lot in films where there's only one woman who can be the dominant one on top. In fact, even you'll see some films where it's like Working Girl is an example, where it's Melanie Griffith versus Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah. There's no, we can't be buddies. And you know, it's no, yeah. 9 to 5 is a rare instance where people in the workplace join together.
But even 9 to 5 had to address that because at first they felt Dolly Parton was working for the man, quote unquote, and they had to bond first before they could move on.
Yes.
So I think that storyline has been used a lot in literature all the way up, you know, till film, and it's starting to become less and less prevalent. Or now with casting, sometimes the woman who plays the bad person is just the bad person, not the bad person towards the other woman.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Like Baywatch. I know that's a weird movie to pull out, but the bad guy is...
Oh, the one with The Rock?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, the...
The bad guy, she's just...
A bad guy because her brother is stupid. I forget what her thing is, but that just pulled... That was the thing that popped in my head.
Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying. She's just a bad guy for the film versus. Yeah.
Because you see that also in romantic comedies too, not just like movies that take place in the workplace or something. There's always one girl, and there are a lot of the shenanigans within the rom-com, especially in the early 2000s, is the girl that you're supposed to be rooting for doing things to the bad girl because she's always bad, you know? And so you see that in rom-coms because it's always about women pitting each other, which is why I think there's this counterculture of movies now where it's like we did it with Booksmart, another shameless plug, rule of threes.
Yes, there we go. Keep going.
That, you know, there's not the pitting of these women together. There's no, you know, romantic boy or romantic girl person that's going to tear them away. You know, so you see this counterculture, and I think it's really nice.
Not counterculture, but more like counter storytelling.
Yeah, you know, where it's where women directors and women writers go, we don't do that in regular day life. Why would we put that on screen?
Yeah, yeah. I think, too, what happens and it makes this really pop out is the fact that you may only have 2 to 3 females in cast in the entire film. And when you have a guy fighting another guy and there's all these other, and there's like 12 other main characters or main supporting characters and they're all men, you get a variation. And you don't get that variation in a film when it's only 3 to 4 women. Also understand that a lot of these directors came up directing westerns or gangster films or films like that that were very genre-oriented, thrillers, mysteries, whatever. And so they usually had an apex hero versus an apex antagonist. And that is really great when you have multiple characters in the film that are all men. Because then the other leads and the other supporting leads, there's a ton of variation there that you get to do. The flip side is when you have a film like All About Eve, and there's only 4 women in a movie about women, and the rest are all men. When you have an apex hero against an apex antagonist, that's all you have. You don't have other women really in that movie. And so that's why we have that trope of the dominant woman versus and the other woman trying to knock her off. Now that you're getting more diversity in casting and film and writing and directing and producing, these issues should fade away over time and become much more reduced. Do you feel like it's getting, like when you watch a film made in the last 10 years or a TV miniseries or a TV show, that it's not so?
I mean, if you take this movie and put it next to some of the other movies that we have put in this season alone, it's been a lot more diverse. But within that diversity, there are new stereotypes. You see that a lot, like what we were just talking about how there's only could be one main woman. A lot of the times that happens with minorities as well. Now we see a lot of these doors opening a lot more too. But based on what we are talking about, just in Hollywood in general, there's a lot of more diversity because there's a lot more women directors, a lot more women stories, a lot more minority stories coming on screen. You know, there was a lot of movies in the last couple of years that have, you know, won a lot of awards, have won a lot of critical praise. It's also pretty prominent what this movie is trying to say, because in the last 2 minutes of this movie, this character shows up and her name is Phoebe. She's like a president of an Eve fan club going, "We love you. So amazing." But the movie ends with Phoebe dressed in holding up Eve's gown, holding Eve's award in a mirror, one of those trifold mirrors. So there's just a Phoebe on Phoebe on Phoebe on Phoebe. There's millions of Phoebes. And that kind of drives home the point of there will always be a successful woman. And then once she reaches her prime, there will be another successful woman knocking her off her pedestal.
The difference between the Eve character and the Margot character for me is Margot got there because she worked hard. She did the best she could. She auditioned. She got the parts. Eve actively went after it and did some pretty underhanded things to get where she wanted to be. She created her whole persona just to get where she wanted. And I think that's the thing that's different about the two, is that Margot is a real person, a real actress. And so when she finally makes some sort of peace with the fact that she's getting older and she's going to get married and she's going to still act and she's still going to do things. Well, she says she's going to give up acting, but then she says, "I'm going to go off and do the play." So you know she's not giving up acting. And Eve is trapped because of the way that she got there. The empty spot in her heart or soul, whichever way you want to argue it, isn't filled by the award she'd won and all the riches and fame. So it was another commentary on, you have to be a real person. If you're doing this for the wrong reasons, it's not going to fill what you want. It's not going to be the cheering and the love that's thrown your way when you're on stage doesn't fill you when you're by yourself in your hotel room.
So we mentioned before that this movie is based off a 1946 short story called The Wisdom of Eve by Mary Orr, O-R-R. And one of the reasons why I want to mention this is because there was a couple of fun facts. Some people think that it was based off an assistant that an actress, Elizabeth Bergner had. It also could have been based on a rivalry between Tallulah Bankhead and Elizabeth Scott, her understudy, during the production of Thornton Wilder's Skin of Our Teeth. One of the reasons why I wanted to mention this is because actually Tallulah Bankhead was actually offered the role of Margot before Betty Davis was offered. So it was kind of almost a full circle.
That's interesting.
That's, you know. And Mankiewicz actually found the story after he started writing a script about an aged actress.
I don't know.
I wrote that down, but that sounds wrong. Like, he was trying to write a story about an actress who had gone past her prime, her perceived prime. But then he read The Wisdom of Eve and changed his script accordingly. He kept many of the story, many characters from the story, including Margot, Eve, and a lot of the other, like, other women characters. But he, like, created new ones, like Bill Sampson, which was the director that Margot was dating, and Addison DeWitt to like, drive the story better. How do you think Addison DeWitt's character adds to the story?
Well, I think it's interesting to have a narrator who's not part of the story narrate it, who eventually you're trying to figure out how he knows so much, and you just realize that he is the male version of Eve, and so he... No, that's not fair to Eve's character. I think the thing is that he's a critic who thinks he knows what's best for everybody, and he takes it to the nth level where he will only support people who he thinks are good. And when he sees that Eve can be good but also a lot like him, very ruthless, he totally uses what he knows to control her. So I thought it was a very interesting narrator, because you had him who's very pessimistic and nihilistic as a narrator, balanced with Karen, who is very optimistic and wholesome as a narrator. And they both narrate the story from different points of view. And so you do have sort of a shifting point of view of where the characters are at. And then they both narrators end up doing something that undermines the person that they want to be ahead. And whereas Karen is sorry she did it, Addison DeWitt is not, because it means that he has more control. So I thought it was a very interesting character.
Yeah. I also thought it was very interesting that the last thing that he says on camera is to Phoebe, goes, do you want a reward, an award like that, pointing to the statue in her hands. And Phoebe goes, yeah, I would love it. And he goes something along the lines of, ask Eve. She knows she has a process to get one of those. And it was kind of bitter. So I thought that was a very interesting ending to his character.
I think it was just like his nihilistic streak coming through. At the end, it doesn't all mean, it doesn't mean anything. So why are you putting so much effort into it? So one of the things, this is the first version or the second version on film?
This is the first version on film.
Okay.
There's only been one movie of All About Eve that's called All About Eve. There has been adaptations, something called like Golden and like Applause, which is like a musical. In 1949, the short story got turned into a radio play called The Wisdom of Eve. Then the movie in 1950 that we're talking about now. She wrote a sequel called More About Eve, which I have not read, so I cannot tell you anything about. Then there was an off-Broadway play called The Wisdom of Eve. And then there was an All About Eve musical, which was called Applause. And that's the one that got, I think, has been turned into a movie, or at least a film adaptation, or a film adaptation of the musical.
That's a movie. Or do you mean a filmed performance?
Filmed performance, that's what I meant.
Okay.
So All About Eve is The Wisdom of Eve is a universal story, you could say, like we talked about before. So a lot of the properties have just been retellings of this story.
After we've talked about this and we watched it, and you've done research on it, was this the film that you were expecting when it was suggested for us?
Yes. When it was suggested after I listened to the short story, yes. But when I didn't really know anything about All About Eve, I thought the movie would have been completely different.
You think it was more going to be a comedy?
It wasn't the film that I was really expecting before I knew what the short story was about, because I would see these posters at like video rental places or just the poster online and things like that. And the theatrical poster to me sends the wrong message of what this movie is about.
What do you mean?
Well, the tagline is, it's all about women, ... And they're men, with an exclamation point, right?
Yeah.
And it's a white background with black and white pictures of all of the characters in their little pairs with little red hearts on their chest with arrows pointing to other characters. So
it was more like you thought it was more like a sex farce, like men and women are changing partners throughout the
Betty Davis's husband had a heart towards Karen, so I thought maybe they would be having an affair based on just the poster.
So yeah, I can see that. I can see how you could read that as part of this is going to be more like a sex farce or a drama where people are having affairs on each other and stuff like that. I never really understood the poster myself, especially since the main focus. But then again, how would you make a poster that talks about this movie other than just having a picture of Betty Davis and Baxter on the cover? That's what they would do nowadays. You just have the two of them.
And probably in that blue and orange outline that they always do.
Yeah. So did you enjoy the film though?
I did really enjoy this film. I did actually. It's actually a really good film that I'm glad the person suggested that we watched it. And I think it lives up to the short story that I was so like engrossed in.
And would you recommend this to somebody?
I would recommend this to somebody. I think it's really a good movie to just watch, especially if you're interested in the history of cinema.
Yeah.
Because I think this movie, or women in cinema, I think this movie is a really good beginning point or middle point in your timeline of the history of cinema, history of women in cinema, things like that.
Well, I also think it's not only is it a good point for that, but it's also a really good thing. I would recommend to people who want to watch really good film acting and how the camera and the actor and the director can work together.
Yeah.
It's definitely staging and the camera moves throughout the film. Not a lot, but moves along. So it's not a very stagey camera. But it also is like, where do you place cameras to get the most out of the camera to get the most out of the scene? Letting the actors and actresses act through the frame, but also framing it such a way that they hit certain marks at certain points in the line, so it adds dramatic effect. It's a really good film to look at and study for how to marry the performance with the camera work.
Well, we hope that you enjoyed this conversation. I know I certainly did. If you do like our podcast or this episode, please leave a review. You can visit us at our own website. That is tmlajourneythroughcinema.com. tmlajourneythroughcinema.com. Super easy to remember. Or you can follow us on Instagram at tmlajourneythroughcinema, Twitter at tmlajourney, or on Facebook under The Movie Log 1.
All that information is listed below in the episode description. All right. Have a great day.
Have a great day.